The studio production was by Jonathan Brown and the editor Heba Ayoub. Plants may lack a brain, but there's a silent intelligence at work, as we hear in today's edition of Plants from Roots to Riches, presented by Kathy Willis, the Director of Science at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew.
How do plants move? Charles Darwin argued about it. Scientists pored over it for centuries. Then in 1934, a relatively unsung hero of botanical science called Kenneth Thyman isolated the chemical responsible, a growth hormone called auxin. It provided the key to understanding plants' ability to respond to all sorts of changes in the environment and influencing a range of processes in higher plants, from the growth of roots to timing of flowering. To some, it was the equivalent of the discovery of the nervous system in animals, and for which, half a century later, Thyman would go on to receive the Boltzmann Prize, the biggest award in science outside of the Nobels. It had been known for a long time that plants move in response to external stimuli. The French name for the sunflower is tournesol, meaning the flower which turns with the sun. Some thought movements were purely mechanical, whereas others believed they reflected some form of sensitivity or awareness to things around it, like touch or even music. Plant movement became an increasingly hot topic for plant scientists in the second half of the 18th century. Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, was an early proponent of what became known as the sensationalist position, arguing that plants were sensitive organisms with a voluntary power of motion. They moved because they chose to. He went so far as to suggest that buds contained a brain that reacted to sensory stimuli, and also that plant behaviour relied at least in part on learned behaviour. As historian Jim Endersby explains, Charles Darwin started to look for scientific evidence behind this movement.
Initially, he's interested in things like mimosa, the sensitive plant, which reacts to touch, to carnivorous plants. He's always fascinated by plants that act in this strangely animal-like way of devouring insects. Climbing plants are a great fascination because of their apparent ability to sense when there is something for them to climb up. He actually writes to his son William, "My hobby horse at present is tendrils. They are more sensitive to a touch than your finger, and wonderfully crafty and sagacious." And the thought that plants can be crafty and intelligent almost is a very new thought.
But if plants had no nervous system, how could they tell what was going on outside? Darwin carried out some very simple experiments to work out how plants react to light. He enlisted the help of his son Francis in the greenhouse in his back garden in Kent. They grew canary grass. Just like your pot plant on your windowsill at home, it leant towards the light. But what made it lean? How did it know which way to move? These elegant experiments, so simple but never bettered, are still carried out to this day by biology students everywhere.
Darwin and his son tried covering the tips of the plants with little tiny hats that block the light out. And sure enough, the grass seedlings don't bend when you do that. They then try covering the base of the seedling and leaving the tip exposed, and the plants bend. So it's something in the tip that causes the bending. So they try cutting the tips off. Sure enough, no bending. Then they tried cutting the tips off and putting a tiny chip of stone, a little bit of silica, in between the tip and the stem. What happens? The plants don't bend. And then the crucial clinching experiment, which is so simple and elegant, they take a little tiny bit of agar gel and they cut the grass tips off and they put this on the gel and leave it there for a few hours. And then they take the little piece of gel and put that back onto the grass stem. And lo and behold, the grass stems bend towards the light. So it's clear that there's a substance, a chemical of some sort, produced in the tip of the plant, which then travels down into the rest of the body of the plant and affects its growth, basically making the cells grow faster on one side than the other so that the plant bends towards the light.
At first, Darwin's ideas were dismissed. Whatever chemical it was, there wasn't much of it. By 1934, it had taken Kenneth Thyman over 5 years to purify enough of it to analyse and finally identify it as being indoleacetic acid, whereupon it was given the name auxin. Mystical ideas about conscious plants listening to Mozart could now be safely jettisoned. We now know that auxins are just one in a suite of hormones that are known to naturally control various functions within plants. One of the most powerful plant hormones is gibberellin, which promotes flowering, seed dormancy and a host of other activities. Viswanbaram Sarasan in Kew's Conservation Biotechnology Unit works with one of the many variants of the gibberellins we're now familiar with, gibberellic acid 3 or GA3. For him, GA3 is a useful tool to ensure elongated stems when propagating young trees, an important requirement if the tree is to go on to develop a healthy root system.
We have done some work on woody plants, and micropropagation of trees is difficult. The elongation process is very important because you need to get good quality materials from these shoot cultures to take them to the next stage, that is the rooting phase. So if they don't elongate properly, you don't get good quality shoot cultures. So GA3, or one of the gibberellins, gibberellic acid 3, GA3 can be added to the culture medium so that you may get shoot elongation. And we have got very good quality cultures from applying GA3 to the medium.
It's this dramatic effect by gibberellin of increasing stem height that lay behind a problem that rice farmers in Asia had long been concerned with. Plant pathologists in Japan had first described the effects at the end of the 19th century while studying bacani, foolish seedling disease, a condition that was seriously lowering the yield of rice crops across Asia. Seedlings, instead of growing strong, quite literally grew tall and fell over. The first paper on the cause of bacani was published in 1898 by the pathologist Shotaro Hori, who demonstrated that the symptoms appeared to be generated by infection with a fungus. Then, in 1935, Tajiro Yabuta was able to show that it was the fungus itself that was causing the rice's unrestrained growth and toppling. He was able to isolate the culprit from the fungus, which he christened gibberellin. But it wasn't until after the Second World War that news of the discovery spread through the scientific community. The race was then on to work out how gibberellin worked, and in doing so, harness its powerful effects. This control of height in crops was to become the most crucial factor in the success of the so-called Green Revolution, which was to transform agricultural practices and dramatically increase global grain production in the developing world from feeding 1 billion people in the late 1950s to 2 billion by the end of the 20th century. Professor Nick Harbord of Oxford University studies plant growth and the impact of gibberellins in plants.
A major component of the Green Revolution was the use of mutant or variant dwarf varieties of crops, wheat and rice, for example, which were much higher yielding than was previously possible because they're more robust. They tend not to fall over, you know, in response to wind and rain. And also they use their energy in a way that favours grain development over stem development.
So their energy is in the actual grain itself rather than in the height of the plant.
Absolutely. So these varieties were enormously influential in the Green Revolution, and they kind of swept around the world. And there were both rice and wheat varieties that are particularly pertinent here. So the rice semi-dwarf varieties of the Green Revolution are mutant forms of rice that actually lack enzymes that are involved in making the hormone. So these are plants that are effectively hormone deficient or have much lower levels of hormone than normal.
There's lower levels of gibberellin in there.
Much lower levels of gibberellin in those plants. So that was the sort of cause of the rice component of the Green Revolution. The wheat component also involves the hormone gibberellin, but it does it in a different way. These now are semi-dwarf wheat varieties, are less responsive to the hormone. So they make the hormone, in fact, interestingly, they make more of it than a normal plant does, but they lack the capacity to respond to the hormone.
Many of the Revolution's breeding programmes were pioneered by the agricultural botanist Norman Borlaug. He'd witnessed famine at home in Minneapolis during the Great Depression, fueling his desire to join the Rockefeller Foundation's Mexican Hunger Project in 1944 to generate rust-resistant varieties of wheat. By the early 60s, Borlaug had begun to introduce dwarfing genes into high-yielding wheat varieties. One of his most notable creations was Norin Tem, a semi-dwarf variety with high-yielding ears. At the same time, other scientists were doing something similar with dwarf rice. They might not have known that it was the plant's response to gibberellins they were altering, but the results were dramatic. Borlaug's dwarf wheat was credited with saving perhaps a billion people from starvation in Mexico, Pakistan and India. His achievement would earn him the 1970 Nobel Prize, not for science, but for peace. Nick Harbord and his team at Oxford have been using genetics to work out the molecular identity of dwarfism and finding out how plants respond to the gibberellin hormone.
We began by making use of a plant which carries a mutation which makes it insensitive to the hormone. So it's a dwarf plant, looks very similar to plants that can't make the hormone, but this one, it's not that it can't make the hormone, it's that it can't respond to the hormone. And essentially, using the kind of peculiar inverse logic of genetics, whereby when things don't work, that's how you work out how they do work, we were able to identify the gene that encodes a protein that's part of the process by which the plant responds to the hormone. And essentially what this protein does is it actually acts as a brake on growth. So you can imagine it like this. So the protein stops the plant from growing, but in the presence of the hormone, it's like taking your foot off the brake, and the hormone stops the brake from working. So what we came to understand from our work was that gibberellin promotes the growth of plants, actually effectively by overcoming the effect of a brake on the growth of plants. So in the gibberellin insensitive plants of the Green Revolution, what you actually have is a mutant form of this protein that is itself insensitive to the hormone. So it carries on acting as a brake on growth even in the presence of hormone. And of course, Norman Borlaug and others were able to use, in the case of wheat, this mutant gene in their crop breeding without knowing the actual identity of the gene that they were using. And that was fine.
But it's just a break on the height rather than anything else in the growth of the plant.
Actually, the height is the most obvious, but it does have a number of other effects. For example, it does make the grain slightly smaller. It makes wheat grains that, when they first germinate, the first little bit of germinating organ that you see is a thing called a coleoptile, and it doesn't grow as tall as it does in normal wheats. And sometimes that can be a problem. So, like Green Revolution wheats, for example, are not widely grown in Australia because of water shortage there, and often they can't break through to the soil surface. So, as with many great advances, it's a trade-off, is that there's good things and bad things about it. And indeed, you know, our modern approaches to agriculture, we have to realise that Green Revolution was built partly on dwarf varieties. It was also built partly on excessive use of nitrogen fertiliser, and we have to think about ways of developing our crops in a more sustainable way, whereby we use the good things about the Green Revolution and try to improve on the things that were not so good.
The Green Revolution and its spectacular increase in plant yields during the second half of the 20th century through harnessing the effect of gibberellin had come at a price. Aside from a high dependence on nitrogen fertilisers, there emerged an increasing reliance on a few high-yielding species that in itself was to dramatically reduce biodiversity. The way we used our planet was changing rapidly. Urbanisation and new agricultural practices were increasing demand on available land. What we meant by biodiversity and how we mapped and measured it were becoming ever more pressing questions. And as we're here, answering them would rely on one of the most important, yet most basic tools in conservation, floras.
That was Professor Kathy Willis with Plants from Roots to Riches. The series is produced by Adrian Washburn. And to discover more about the plants featured in the series, search for Plants from Roots to Riches online, where you can download each episode as a podcast.
The best, most informed dinner party chat you've ever heard.
BBC Radio 4's culinary panel show returns with guests from all ends of the foodie spectrum.
The Kitchen Cabinet prides itself on not lining up the usual suspects. Yes, there are a few cooks you may have heard of, but we have cookery teachers, we have people who are really there because they're just greedy, we even have a psychologist specialising in the psychology of taste.
Jay Rayner presents a new series of The Kitchen Cabinet on Saturday morning at 10:30.